The inspiration for this talk was that I didn't know what to talk about, so I asked one of the day students yesterday, what would you like to hear about? And instantly the reply came back, I want you to explain the shortest route to non-suffering. Okay. The shortest route to non-suffering then. So we need to know what non-suffering is. Which is, we all do experience from time to time non-suffering. But I thought it might be helpful to try and determine what suffering was. And if you know what suffering is, then the absence of suffering would be non-suffering, won't it? Which is clear enough. And I'm grateful to another meditator who, when they emailed recently, gave a link to an article that appeared in an online paper with a story in the paper about a local man. This is in Gaithersburg, Maryland, in the United States. And so this was to demonstrate what I mean by suffering. See if you recognise this yourselves. Gaithersburg, Maryland. Local man, Marshall Platt, 34, came tantalisingly close to kicking back and having a good time while attending a friend's barbecue last night, before remembering each and every one of his professional and personal obligations. While cracking open his second beer, as he chatted with friends over a relaxed outdoor meal, Platt was reportedly seconds away from letting go and enjoying himself when he was suddenly crushed by the full weight of work emails that still needed to be dealt with, looming deadlines for projects that would still take a great deal of time and energy to complete, and phone calls that needed to be returned. Platt, who reportedly sunk into a distracted haze after coming to the razor's edge of experiencing genuine joy, fully intended to go through the motions of talking with friends and appearing to have a good time, while he mentally shopped for a birthday present for his mother. Everything's fine, said the tense, mentally disturbed man. It's actually mentally absent man, but he is disturbed, undoubtedly. Everything's fine, he said to his girlfriend, who asked him what was wrong. And then he remembered that he hadn't called his aunt to check up after her surgery, her recent surgery. I'm having fun, he said. According to sources, Platt tried to put his responsibility-laden thoughts out of his mind and loosen up by opening another beer, but suddenly remembered a magazine subscription that needed to be renewed by Friday, a medical bill that he thought might now be overdue, and the fact that he needed to do laundry by tonight or he'd run out of clean socks and underwear. The article goes on and on, eventually with him leaving, not remembering one thing about the evening that he'd spent. And that's what I mean by suffering. It's that sense in which you're not free to be just spontaneously doing whatever you're doing. If that's being at a barbecue, you can't just be at a barbecue. There's a weight. There's something that's keeping you separated. There's a sense of separation from it, of this invisible veil. And with it, all the preoccupations. Now, this is a completely made-up example, but there is a germ of truth in it, isn't there? That our worries, our anxieties play on our minds and stop us from just spontaneously enjoying the life that we have. So that's what I mean by suffering. So consequently, non-suffering must be the reverse of that. The freedom to do the things we want to do without all that psychological baggage, without all that sense, that apparently perennial sense that there's something wrong. So the question is, what's the shortest route to get to that point? So the question is, firstly, is it possible to be free of all that preoccupation? And of course those preoccupations can be the most trivial things, all the way down to the most deep-rooted anxiety about our place in the cosmos and the whole anxiety surrounding our mortality and life and death and everything. Because even if consciously we're not particularly worrying about that at this time, that is a worry for everyone. That is the most basic existential angst that everyone experiences, not knowing, not understanding our place in the universe. Of course that's going to give us a sense of separation from it. So is it possible to come to a complete understanding and therefore be able to completely let go of all these preoccupations and so forth? And the answer is yes, most definitely. And the shortest route I know is Vipassana meditation, insight meditation. Now, Vipassana meditation, insight meditation by itself will never be enough. But what I'd like to try and do is try to use an analogy to try and explain why it is that coming to understanding, coming to enlightenment, does take time. And in hopefully in doing that, be able to demonstrate what therefore will help speed that process up, if you see what I mean, to make it the shortest possible journey that you can. It's as though, as a teacher, you know where the gate is, the gate to understanding. And people come up to you and say, where's the gate? Oh, I really want to go through the gate. I really want to understand. And you say, right, you see this path, you see the gate at the end, just walk through the gate and you'll be free. And it really is that quick, that short, that simple. It really is. It's just walk up that path, go through the gate, and you'll be free. And then as a teacher, it's quite interesting to sort of then take a step back. And this is an analogy. I hope you take it in the spirit that it's meant. But it is quite critical of students. So you said to somebody, just walk up to the gate and go through the gate and you'll be free. And so one student, say, just stands there and goes, they said, well, you wanted to go through the gate, just go through the gate. And just, no, not go. Not going. But you wanted to understand, didn't you? Not going. Yeah, okay. So there's somebody else there, and you say, just walk up there, and the gate's there, and you go through, and you'll be fine. And they're in a deck chair reading a book, and they go, you wanted to know, and they say, well, after I finished the book. And they're just sitting in the chair, and they're just reading the book. I'm making this up as I go along, as you can probably tell. I did have some examples. I can't remember them now. Somebody else, you sort of say, right, there it is, there's the gate, you just go up there, and they just run as fast as they can in the opposite direction. There are some people that you say, there's the gate, just go there, and then a few minutes later you see them running off in a field somewhere over there. Somebody's asleep. People are doing everything other than just following the instructions just to walk up to the gate and go through. Now, there are some people that are kind of zigzagging their way and sort of coming back on themselves, caught in a loop. But you can see that gradually they are sort of veering towards the gate. Because the gate's only there. It's not, like, miles away. It's right there. And every now and again, somebody reaches the gate, and that's just a tremendous thing to behold. So in this analogy, what does all this doing everything else other than walking up to the gate and going through, what does it symbolise? It symbolises all our ways in which we try to avoid the fact of our suffering. It's all the ways that we crave for life to be different. It's all our emotional attachments that have been developed through that craving for life to be different. And of course, we've been developing the capacity for craving, for desiring life to be different, for avoiding the fact of suffering. For such a very long time, we've become very skilled, and it's become very comfortable in its own way. It's a comfortless comfort, but it's still very comfortable because it's the known, it's very familiar. So isn't it inevitable then that we'll approach the path? Because after all, that gate, the gateway to enlightenment, it is actually suffering. So if we spent all this time trying to avoid suffering, we'll do whatever we can to avoid the gate. if you get the analogy. Because what Buddhist meditation is all about is recognizing suffering, understanding suffering, understanding the causes of suffering directly for ourselves. So we have this natural opposition based on our conditioning, which says, but I don't want to face my suffering, thank you. So we try to do everything not to, to look at suffering. So we employ those techniques. So it's inevitable that somebody will try to sleep their way, who have habitually tried to sleep their way out of their problems, that they will have difficulty with sleeping in a meditation state. Or if, like poor Marshall Platt, who uses worry, the worry is intended to, through thinking about the problem, that will solve the problem. And I'm sure most meditators are familiar with worry as a problem in meditation. So the worry, which is the way of trying to avoid suffering, is brought into the meditative arena as well. This is inevitable. So I think if we come back to the original question, what's the shortest way to non-suffering, you can see that there is a challenge here. Before we can go through that gate, we have to sufficiently understand ourselves, our motives, our habits, our views, our aspirations, and how they cause us to act in particular ways before we can go through the gate. Or to put this another way for you, whilst you still have an emotional attachment to life being one way or another, you can never come to understand the whole. And enlightenment is understanding the whole and what that is. And so if there is still an emotional attachment to any part, whether it be a physical thing or a mental thing, that will prevent anybody from becoming enlightened. That will prevent them from going through the gate. So walking the Noble Eightfold Path is the shortest and most direct way to get to the gateway to enlightenment, because it acknowledges the fact that what you have to do is deal with your emotional attachments and free yourself from your emotional attachments, all your cravings, all your anxieties, your fears, your worries, your daydreams, your dreams. Okay, so how are emotional attachments let go of? There's two parts to this. What we have to get to is the deeply held wrong views and wrong perceptions that we have about life. We only emotionally attach to anything out of ignorance, out of not understanding life. So the process of vipassana is to look intently at our subjective experience and look intently at the way experience comes into being and passes away again, moment by moment. That will undercut all the roots of our emotional attachments. Vipassana does not get you enlightened. Nothing in the Noble Eightfold Path can bring you full enlightenment. Well, that's got you thinking, hasn't it? Nothing can make enlightenment happen. What the Noble Eightfold Path does is put you in a place where nothing can prevent it from happening. It creates the perfect supporting conditions for true enlightenment, this stepless step to understanding to occur. What Vipassana does is removes, through looking at transience, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self, in all aspects of our experience, what that does is remove the emotional attachment to the things of the world, because you see that there isn't anything to attach to. There is nothing you can grasp after. The dreams, all the dreams, are empty of any substance. The worries, the anxieties, the fears are empty of any substance. Life is truly empty. What Vipassana does is bring you to the point of freedom from those emotional attachments that prevent true understanding. But to do that difficult work of looking very closely at life, you have to be free of hindrances. And hindrances are the conscious expression of our emotional attachments. So when we worry our way through a meditation, when we dream our way through a meditation, what we need to do is to learn to acknowledge those hindrances and set those hindrances to one side. So there has to be a conscious renunciation of our attachments in the moment, to temporarily put aside them as distractions, so that you can then observe the three marks. So it's a twofold process. Conscious setting aside of hindrances, but that's never going to be enough. You have to then practice the observation of the three marks again and again and again. That will undercut the roots of the problem. What we have to understand about craving, which is what the hindrances are, is that a craving is always an attempt to solve the problem of suffering. They're always undertaken out of a desire to be free of suffering, to avoid suffering. So we have found them in the past to be successful. They have been our shortest route to non-suffering, in a very temporary sense, i.e., you can drink yourself to oblivion, and that will do the job temporarily, because if you're unconscious, you're not suffering. It's quite straightforward, that one. So the point is then that you have to sacrifice that shortcut to non-suffering. Does that make sense? You have to be willing to renounce it, to set it to one side, and remain with the suffering. Ah, that's so not nice, but it has to be done. If you can remain with the suffering, painful feelings, the unwanted perception, the contraction when you have your views brought under scrutiny and tested, or your fears, your anxieties, your worries, if you can remain with them, you can see that their nature is to arise and pass away. As the more you see that they arise and pass away, the less troubled you are by them. The less troubled you are by your suffering, the less you have to resist and want it to be different. So it's by remaining with the suffering, however that manifests for you, consciously, in the moment. It's through experiencing that fully and not trying to seek its opposite, non-suffering, that the suffering is gradually let go of. Because if you resist, you crank it up one notch. If you resist again, you crank it up another notch. And the suffering just intensifies and intensifies and intensifies. As soon as you stop and allow that suffering to be there, you can begin to see that it's transient. It changes, it does not remain the same. That's not easy. Hence why in the Noble Eightfold Path, we develop right energy, right mindfulness, and right concentration. It has to be a developed thing. You have to develop the skill. Now, in order to do that, you also have to live a life of good conduct. Because it's the same process, the same pattern. When people break the precepts, they do so because they don't want to suffer. They want to find the shortest route to non-suffering. So, amazingly enough, but it is the case when people harm and kill, and when they steal, when they practice sexual misconduct, when they practice wrong speech, and when they indulge in intoxicants, they do so because they believe that by doing so, they will solve the problem of their suffering. And perhaps in some kind of way, shape or form, it does, in a very temporary sense. So for Buddhist meditators, that's why it's so critically important that the precepts are kept as best one can, because that restraint in one's action then demonstrates quite clearly where one's emotional attachments are, where one suffers, where one wants life to be different. And that means through that restraint, you can actually be with the suffering. Do you see? It all fits perfectly. If somebody keeps the precepts as best they can for a period of time, they discover that that has a very marked and beautiful knock-on effect, that when they sit in meditation, they're calm, they're less worried about their reputation, there's more self-esteem, there's great sense, more sense of peace with one's life generally, because you're not creating massive waves. So again, in order to keep the precepts, it does require mindfulness. It does require right view and right aspiration. But we begin to see that each factor in the Noble Eightfold Path, because with ethics you have right speech, right action, and right livelihood. By aspiring to rightness, doing the right thing for a Buddhist meditator, reduction in suffering that comes through renunciation of inefficient action, shows us where our suffering is, shows us where our resistances are, and through that, and this is why Gateway to Enlightenment is suffering, you begin to see how transient the painful feelings are, the unwanted perceptions are. And gradually, gradually, you lose the inclination towards resistance. So it's no surprise to me that in my analogy of the gate and people wandering about and doing all sorts of funny stuff other than just walking up to the gate and passing through, that's completely understandable, because we're all conditioned, we've all got habitual tendencies. But that's why it's so important that if somebody wants to understand, if they want to be free of suffering, why it's so important that they be willing to accept instruction, whatever that instruction happens to be, regardless of what that instruction happens to be. Because you can bet your bottom dollar that there's going to be an instruction in there that goes against your emotional attachments. There's bound to be, isn't there? There has to be something. Because if there isn't anything, why did you come to see us? Because you're not suffering. So there has to be something that you're going to get hooked up on. There has to be, you know, for somebody it might be feeling really uncomfortable with the idea of not wearing makeup, but they come on retreat and they don't wear makeup, so they rest with the discomfort, they rest with the suffering, and they don't try to seek its opposite. And through observing the way that discomfort arises and passes, and that it's that discomfort is only there sometimes, and other times they're not thinking about the way they look at all, the less they worry about the way they look. It doesn't mean that their preference for, you know, looking all right is harmed in any way. It's just the attachment to their image is let go of. Do you see? Is that a practical example? And these days, apparently, this is beginning to mean as much to men as to women. Not me, currently. That's why it is such a good idea that if you want to follow this way, you understand this, because that means that you understand why the teacher is saying, no, 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 you've got to do this anyway. I know you don't want to do it, but you've got to do it anyway. Because all the teacher's doing is saying, look, there's the gate, and you're just standing there, or whatever it is. It's because there is a blockage, and that block is an emotional attachment. So that's why the place is set up in the way it is. That's why the Noble Eightfold Path is the way it is. You know, it doesn't have to take very long. It's up to each individual. Oh, this will make you laugh. Because time is just completely irrelevant. I've mentioned this to two people, and they both laughed. It is quite personal, but when I completed the training in 2006, I started doing samatha meditation, calming meditation, under the guidance of my teacher Alan. So what are we now? 2013. So 7 years. Okay. Recently, I went in to see Alan because there'd been a bit of a development with the samatha, and it was going quite well. And so I explained it all to him, and he sat there and he said, and quite genuinely, he wasn't putting me down or anything. He quite genuinely said, "Oh yeah, yeah, I remember when I got to the same point, but for me, it was after 2 days." You're laughing. Everyone laughs at that. Why do they laugh at that? Why do you find that so funny? 7 years. And it took him 2 days. Because we're all different. And who can possibly say who has developed what? The only way of finding out is to develop it to the best of your ability. You can shorten the length of time it takes through developing enough of the supporting conditions. So, coming regularly on a Wednesday, meditating every day, keeping the precepts, developing the parami, coming for regular interviews with the teacher, coming on retreats, becoming a day student, coming in for full-time training. As much as you put into it, you are creating the most ideal supporting conditions, accepting instruction, faithfully putting the instruction into practice in order to find out what happens, going back to the teacher and discussing it. Those are all the things that speed it up, because those are all the things that are renouncing the shortcuts that we've employed to try and get away from suffering. And they all involve acknowledging the suffering, being willing to look at it and work at it in order to come to understand and overcome it. So your speed is dependent on your attitude. But where you are in terms of your attitude is a very personal thing, of course. And no two people are alike. The point that the Noble Eightfold Path brings you to, and all that it can do, is bring you into the moment, finally free of all your emotional attachments to life, any aspect of life. It doesn't in any way impair your ability to enjoy life or experience life to the full. It's just the attachments are completely let go of through this process of looking at the three marks. The mind in that state is beautifully quiet. It doesn't mean there isn't thinking going on, but there might be just one issue, the issue about, well, I've done all this, what is this gateway? How do I get through this gate, whatever that is? Once that is properly let go of too, and there is no more attachment even to the idea of enlightenment itself, at which point the mind just sees the whole thing. It just sees the whole, it just understands life in this beautiful, miraculous moment. From not understanding life, it suddenly just understands everything. It's not that you saw something and said, oh, that must be this and that must be that, so that must be, and therefore I must be nothing doing. It's just a moment of just perfect seeing what was always there, but we're always ignored because we're always trying to get away from suffering. And it's not a thought. It's not an intuition. It literally cannot be described. It's quite astonishing. It only came because of that restraint of wanting life to be different and that willingness to experience suffering. When the true enlightenment comes, there is the perfect seeing that the reason that everyone is not enlightened is because they haven't stopped. And you realise that in that moment you did stop. And one of the things that drives me balmy is when I hear it said that there is nothing you need to do, you're already enlightened. Based on what I've been talking about, it doesn't really fit, does it? You do realise what's meant by that. But you also, if you're properly enlightened, you also look back at your life and you see the terrible suffering that you went through in order to become enlightened. You saw that it was impossible, without some restraint in terms of your behaviour, it was impossible to undercut your emotional attachments. Without looking directly at life and observing transience and so forth, it would have been impossible to... How would you have got rid of the emotional attachments? And you know definitely that without having got rid of the emotional attachments, true understanding couldn't have blossomed. So when I hear that, I do tend to think, I wonder quite where they're coming from. And the beautiful thing is that it really is the case that it's just like a stepless step. It's like you don't actually take a step. There is no step to take anywhere. And yet, in that moment, your universe is completely transformed. And, of course, the thing that is missing completely, because there's just total understanding of life. It doesn't mean you know everything about physics. It's not omniscience in that sense. But you totally understand that suffering arises because of craving. And that craving is based in ignorance, and that ignorance has now completely gone away. So the mind is just beautifully quiet. And it just goes from experience to experience, experiencing what's going on, whether it's a beautiful walk in a meadow, or standing up in front of lots of people and your mind going completely blank, or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And it's just, well, that's just what's happening. That's just what's happening. So you're just there with it. So you could even be at a barbecue in Maryland or wherever, and there would be none of that worry, anxiety. It doesn't mean that you don't know that there are emails that you've got to deal with, or you know, you've got to remember your mum's birthday or things like that. But it doesn't... Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't grasp at the mind. It's not a problem. You get to that, you deal with that. So the mind remains delightfully quiet because it doesn't expect life to be different than it is. And it's entirely timeless. And you look back at... Because now you see life in its right context, you realise that no time has elapsed. That it is truly timeless. That this whole problem of... Because people think about, oh, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, I've been doing this for 10 years, I've been doing this for a year, I've been doing this for 6 months, why aren't I enlightened? And you look back, you get over that, and you look back, and you realise that no time has elapsed at all. You only thought that time had elapsed, but no time has elapsed at all. It's quite astonishing, because you realise that nothing actually ever happens. Well, that's on that bombshell, because as I have gone over...